بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. I think we make a start with سورة الفاتحة. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، الحمد لله رب العالمين، الرحمن الرحيم، مالك يوم الدين، إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين، اهدنا الصراط المستقيم، صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين. أعوذ بالله السميع العليم من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، الحمد لله رب العالمين، وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين، ولعن الله على أعدائهم أجمعين من الأولين والآخرين، آمين يا رب العالمين. أما بعد، so السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. And this is part 9 of our ongoing series of discussions on the book by Imam Sadiq titled Misbah al-Sharia. And like I say at the beginning of each one of these, I strongly recommend that the previous parts, the previous write-ups or the videos are watched by anyone watching this one in order to avoid any confusion or misunderstanding within this subject matter, because the nature of the subject matter, the style of discussion, it requires that each part build upon the one that came before. So I very strongly recommend that anyone watching this or reading the write-up have a look at the previous ones and then continue with this one. But of course, we'll do a brief recap. In previous sessions, we actually continued our journey of discovery regarding the subject of prophethood. Previously, we had discussed the philosophy of prophethood, the mission of the prophets, and in the last session, we discussed the prophetic resurrection of society. And we learned that the transformation that the person of the prophet goes through when he is appointed for his mission by the Lord of the universes is one that compels him to deliver this change and to make this change within his society, within the people. We learned that a prophet stands up to systems that are rooted in ignorance or jahiliyyah, and he works to raise society towards a system which is tawheed orientated or God-centric. And to illustrate this example, we used a part of the story of Pharaoh and Moses as narrated by God in the Quran in chapter Al-Qasas, in Surah Al-Qasas, which is the chapter of the narrations, number the 28th chapter of the Quran, verses 4 to 6, which reads, "Indeed, Pharaoh tyrannized over the land, reducing its people to factions, abasing one group of them, slaughtering their sons and sparing their women. Indeed, he was one of the agents of corruption. But we desire to show favor to those who are abased in the land, and to make them the leaders, and to make them heirs, and to establish them in the land, and to show Pharaoh, Haman, and their hosts from them that of which they were apprehensive." Now, we discuss these verses, and we understood how Pharaoh was abasing a portion of society. And more importantly, we learned that since God has explicitly used the present tense when declaring we desire, this means that this help from God to those who are abased in the land is not just fixed for a particular time, meaning it's not fixed just for the Israelites, but rather this is always in place. And that God is always the one who desires to support and lift up those who are abased in the land, those who are oppressed in the land. And this is actually an extremely important point, and one that everyone should reflect on in and of itself. Now, what is the purpose of causing this change within society? What is the goal of the prophets? This is what we're going to be trying to discuss in our session today, as I had hinted to in the previous session. So with ourselves filled with great purpose to learn and understand this subject of prophethood, let us call in unison, call out to the Lord of all knowledge, that perchance we can understand this subject clearly, and let us begin our discussion with his most beautiful of names. Please give me a salawat.
Allahumma salli ala
Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
So the verse of Quran that is the, we call it Inwan, it's like the subject of this discussion, is verse number 25 of Surah Al-Hadid, which is the chapter of the Ayan, the 57th chapter of the Quran. And the verse reads, "Certainly we sent our prophets with manifest proofs, and we sent down with them the book and the balance, so that humanity may maintain justice, and we sent down iron in which there is great might and uses for humanity, and so that God may know those who help him and his messenger in their absence. Indeed, God is all strong, almighty." So previously we learned that the prophet initially undergoes a transformation within himself, following which he brings a transformation within the fabric, or attempts to bring a transformation within the very fabric of society. A transformation that is a reflection of his own inner transformation. He causes a profound change in the social structure. In the session today, we're going to try and understand what the purpose of causing this change is. We will examine the question in the general sense that it encompasses all of the missions of all of the prophets of God. Now, this subject is not only relevant to our overall discussion from many perspectives, but actually, you could argue it's entirely essential to it. And there are three key points that we will attempt to cover through the course of this discussion. The first one is, what mission does a prophet follow? Second one, what goal does he pursue? And the third one is, what does he want to achieve? So, the primary goal of any prophet is one thing and one thing alone. However, the path that leads to that goal comprises a number of intermediate goals that must be achieved in order for the primary goal to be achieved. And the primary goal of all of God's messengers can be summed up in just a few words. The prophet came to this world in order to guide humanity upwards and towards perfection, for which they, humanity, were created. As a creature, the human being is endowed with many latent potentialities. He has countless abilities and energies, all of which enable him to become something higher, something nobler, something greater than what he is in appearance. From the moment a person is born, from the moment that a world exists for him, he is on a journey toward perfection and forever in a state of growth and development. This is clearly visible with regard to the physical existence of their body. For example, a newborn baby lacks many of the physical features possessed by an adult. For example, a newborn baby lacks teeth, lacks a strong jaw, lacks a firm grip, lacks the ability to walk. Even its internal organs, such as, for example, those of the digestive tract, are not fully mature when it comes into the world. All of these mean that it cannot immediately live like an ordinary human being. Its brain and nervous system are also still developing. However, after some time, the child begins to develop all of these facilities, and nothing is added from the outside that is not already there. The baby's little jaw gets stronger. Its tiny hands learn to grip things tightly. Those little legs, which could not carry its own weight, become stronger and steadier. Its nervous system develops, and its brain, which at one point could not even hold the most basic of thoughts, now becomes able to understand the most important and complex questions of its existence. Nothing is added to this child from the outside. All of this comes from within. These are all the child's latent potential and unrealized abilities, which, with the passage of time and the fulfillment of the necessary conditions, blossom in this child and become visible. A child has the potential to speak, and later acquires the ability to do so. A child has the potential to think, to understand, and to learn, and will grow to do all of these things. Therefore, from the moment he comes into this world, the human being is forever growing and moving toward perfection. Things which were not, but came to be, could not, but then became able, which had no intellect, but then came to acquire one, lacked experience, but later gained it. They all belong in this category. In matters of the human body, as we have all understood now, we find that human beings are always growing. In other words, the human being is always increasing what he or she has and gaining things which he or she previously did not have. But this is also true of matters pertaining to the moral and spiritual life of the human being. There is a whole world of potential which is hidden deep within the human being. We could compare the human being to a rich mine buried deep below the ground, which, when mined, is seen to contain wonders. But as long as it remains buried, it's nothing but dirt and dust. Please give me a salawat.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Now, if we think of the human being like a, for example, like a mosaic painting, when they want to make a mosaic, they first have to create the template upon which they're going to lay the tiles and the gemstones and everything. They spread everything out on a flat surface. Now, if you were to see this flat surface before any of the tiles or gemstones were put in place, you wouldn't see any trace of finery or art or beauty in that surface. However, once the tiles are put into place, when the polishing starts to happen, this is where you see this dark matter become bright and clear, and many things start to appear that were previously hidden by the dirt, dust, and such things. As the polishing process exposes the mosaic tiles to friction, you see things in this previously dark matter which you had no idea even existed. As they continue to polish the outer layer, you see that this contains beautiful stones of many hues and colors, intricate patterns, and bright, bright colors. All of these were hidden earlier in the dark matter. That brings all of them together. This dark matter brings it all together, but it hides everything. Indeed, as a casual observer, you may not even have realized that there is any such beauty within. Finally, once the surface has been fully polished, washed, and scrubbed clean, you see something beautiful, beautiful stones, beautiful colors, patterns, and geometric shapes, and so much more that this mosaic contains. You can see beautiful sections of this mosaic, the beauty that was previously hidden. The great potential that lay hidden within the human soul is very much like this mosaic. And the stones found within the dark matter of the mosaic, before it is scrubbed, before it is polished and washed to reveal its beauty, this is like the potentialities, the potential within the human soul. The human being that you see is like an uncut, unpolished stone, something you can find at a gem store shop or in a mine shop. That small child that cannot speak has nothing special for anyone except naturally for the parents. But as we can see, there is a wealth of treasure buried within this child's soul. He or she has deep reserves of special qualities. There is a beauty there that is waiting to be discovered. There are potentialities there that are waiting to be unlocked. As the famous Iranian poet Sa'adi once said, "Just as a bird takes flight, you must leave behind the fetters of desire and soar with wings of humanity." This is from Golestan of Sa'adi, the Rose Garden of Sa'adi of Shiraz. And this is actually a truth that has been expressed in speech, in verse, by mystics and poets alike for generations. They say that the human being is a resplendent being. Humanity is higher even than the angels. The human being contains an overflowing spring of goodness, of beauty, of potential that needs only to be brought forth into the world. You could say that each human being is ready to flourish and grow and to ascend towards perfection. And the real goal of the prophets is to guide humanity on this journey. This is what we find described in the Quran with words like tazkiyah, which means refinement. And also ta'aleem, which means education. The prophets came to expunge the negative traits from human beings, to lead them away from following their base desires, to save them from a way of living that was merely animalistic. Indeed, the famous mystic Rumi has remarked, and this is from Rumi's Masnavi, book number 4, lines 3662 to 3663. And he says, "O you wolves who tear at the shirts of Josephs, awaken from this heavy slumber. Those who have the appearance of humans while having the character of wolves, those who give pleasant smiles while acting like monsters, those people cannot be called human. A person who enjoys shedding blood, a person who delights in inflicting death and destruction on others, who is not saddened by seeing the ordeals of his fellow man, who remains unmoved by the suffering of others, this person is not a human being, regardless of appearances that might indicate the contrary. Is he very smart? Is he very wealthy? Is he very powerful? Is he very well presented? He could be all of these, but none of these add up to a human being. Knowledge, wealth, power, and presentation, humanity is something else entirely. The prophets came to purify humanity, and you'll not find any trace of animal behavior or animalistic behavior in the preachings and teachings of the prophets. You'll find no sign of the animal level of existence in the lifestyle of the prophets. All you will find is the pure light of humanity, and this is one of their greatest miracles. Please give me a salawat.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Now, when people think of prophetic miracles, they imagine displays of supernatural power and demonstrations of impossible acts. They imagine prophets causing walls to crumble or trees to grow, and all of these type of things. Now, granted, the prophets certainly performed miracles comparable to these. There's no doubt in that. However, the greatest miracle of the prophets was something else entirely. It was the creation of a virtuous human being. And honestly speaking, what miracle could be greater than this? Now, there might be someone who's committing every criminal and immoral act imaginable. But upon being polished by the message of Islam, that is the tool that the prophet uses to polish the human soul, this man is suddenly and entirely transformed. The same person who yesterday would not hesitate to do wrong, whom no, and I mean, no one would expect such a person to become a paragon of virtue. But through this polishing by the prophet, by the message of Islam, such a person can become so. Take an example. What kind of person was Abu Dhar before Islam? Abu Dhar was a very rough desert nomad who had no regard for humanity at all. He was the kind of person that if he was killed in an earthquake, no one would bat an eyelid. If 1,000 Abu Dhars were killed in an earthquake, no one would bat an eyelid. He was a man who did not understand and who did not want to understand. There was not a grain of compassion in his persona, and there was not a shred of interest in virtue. He was a wild-looking figure who had grown up in the harshest of landscapes in the Arabian desert. Now, if you saw him, would you have any sympathy for him? If a great moral teacher saw him, would he have hope that such a man could change? Many people who call themselves teachers or reformers tend to not have much concern for people like Abu Dhar. Rather, they prefer to work on people who recognize their importance and hearken to their words, people who are already educated and thinking. However, the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, his pure family, and righteous companions, was able to take this rough, uncut, unpolished stone that was Abu Dhar And through the polish of revelation and preaching, he was able to make a human being. Furthermore, not just any human being, a human being who displayed every possible moral virtue available to humanity. This is the prophet's greatest miracle. To make a man who puts aside all ego and selfishness, which is the axis around which most people, most men's lives turn, and is willing to and turn it into turn that man into someone who is willing to sacrifice everything for the cause of truth. Could you find such a person under normal circumstances? We want everything for ourselves and the things connected to ourselves, our businesses, our titles, our children, our names, and of course, our own personas. Abu Dharr sacrificed everything he had. Everything that went back to his own self, he sacrificed for the sake of God and for the sake of the Prophet to walk the path that was laid out before him. This is what it means to be human. A human being with these qualities is transformed into a human being of this type. What is capable of effecting such a change? The revelation and preaching of the Prophet. From this dull stone, the Prophet made a glistening jewel. This is the purpose of prophethood, to transform humanity. Please give me a salawat.
اللهم صل على محمد
صلي
وعلى
على محمد وآل محمد.
Now, yes, it is of the utmost importance to set up the proper social order. It is essential to have a system that brings freedom and prosperity to everyone. However, when discussing this, we must also ask that once we have a society in which there is freedom, prosperity combined with social justice, and class differences have been eradicated, and people are living and growing up in such a society, what comes next? What goal do materialist philosophers assign the human being who lives in such an ideal society? What is the purpose of humanity? Human beings struggle and sacrifice in order to create a free society. But once they have it, what comes after? What do we do with this freedom now that we have it? For example, when you build a mosque, a masjid, there must be a purpose for this mosque after it has been built, so that when the construction finishes, the people will come to the mosque and pray, or listen to sermons, or worship, or many such things. It is entirely meaningless for us to build a mosque with all the money, the time, the effort, and everything that goes into this, only for the mosque to remain unused. Why did we build this mosque? What do we do now that it's finished? We would say, nothing. We just wanted to build a mosque. That would be absurd and ridiculous, not to mention hideously wasteful. And yet, this is exactly what materialist philosophies say about the creation of a just and fair society. Materialist philosophies say that we should develop the world, eliminate poverty, uproot ignorance, and build a better society, a human society, a society in which there is no class division, in which there is no division or exploitation. Wonderful. But once we have such a society, what are the human beings supposed to do with it? What are they supposed to do in it? Materialist philosophies don't have an answer to this. What is to become of humanity in such a society? They have no answer. Are people meant to just eat, drink, and sleep and make merry? Are they just meant to have an easy life and that's it? Or are we supposed to struggle and sacrifice just for people to have an easy life? Just so that people can, for example, just eat, drink, and sleep with ease. Is that all we want? This is where material ideologies ultimately fail. Theistic philosophies, on the other hand, they say there is a further goal to be achieved. There is a higher goal for which the creation of a just social order is a prerequisite, is a requirement. And that this higher goal is to elevate the human being. In fact, it is to make men into human beings. A man is not the same thing as a human. Remember that. A man is not the same thing as a human. A man is a creature that walks on two legs, but a human is something more, something much more. To become a human, a person must realize their latent potential and acquire virtue. Now, a question might come to mind. Okay, someone does that, then what? To which the answer is, there is no then. Because the human being is limitless and God is limitless, and so this journey is never ending. And if we reflect on the verse of Quran, which is from Surah Al-Baqarah, the chapter of the cows, second chapter of the Quran, verse number 156, where God says, "We are from God, and to Him is our return." Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. Many times we say this only when we hear about someone passing away, but we should reflect on this. When the human being sets out upon the path of perfection, there is no end to this road. This is the idea that lies at the core of Tawheed, of monotheism, and all of the world's great religious traditions. The human being is forever ascending onwards and upwards. The human being is forever climbing to new heights. There is no end. And it is for this ideal that the prophets were sent. If we look at this, we are from God and to Him is our return. This means that we are constantly moving towards God. It's not like we're just one day going to stop and return back to Him. No, it's a constant journey that we're going on. The prophets came to save mankind from vice, degeneracy, ignorance. From allowing their latent potentialities to remain hidden, they came to make real human beings. This is the primary goal of the prophets. Please give me a salawat.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
And in fact, the Quran tells this to us on many occasions. We've seen in the verse, for example, verse number 164 of the Surah Ali Imran, the chapter of the family of Imran, where God says, God certainly favored the faithful when He raised up amongst them an apostle from amongst themselves to recite to them His signs and to purify them and to teach them such that before they were in manifest error. So the prophets came to enhance the human being. To adorn him with virtue and to purify him from vice. This is the goal of the prophets. This is why our own prophet is narrated to have said, and in fact, this is the hadith that is the basis of all of our discussions here on the Lantern of the Path, where Prophet Muhammad is known to have said, "Indeed, I was sent to complete the noble character." This is a very famous tradition, a very famous saying of Prophet Muhammad, and we used it right at the beginning of the first session that we had on Misbah Sharia, on the Lantern of the Path. So this is the first point. But there is an even more important point to consider. Many a time we have heard this point that the mission of the prophets is always one of moral refinement and development. To this, a person could turn around and say, "Okay, we know where to go. We've understood what we must do. So stop stirring up trouble and give up fighting. Instead, let's go to a monastery and let's live as monks. We'll spend all our time purifying ourselves and becoming better people, and we will save ourselves. Then, if someone comes to us and is receptive, we can teach him how to do the same, and we'll make him a better person too." We could say this, person could say this. However, this attitude is often used as an excuse for being lazy and quietist and saving one's own skin and choosing the path of least resistance, the easiest path. Because it can be used to excuse these traits, and we find this is repeated very, very often. Such words, they please people, they please rulers, they please people who bear the responsibility of educating and guiding people because they are. Without any sort of threat, they are without any sort of consequence. Moral refinement is something straightforward and easy to preach. It does not bring you into conflict with other people. You just need to gather a handful of people, tell them some nice stories, Make them a little less selfish and say you've helped them on the path to spirituality and moral refinement. It is also easy for people, or at least it looks easy for them. In reality, it's not, but it looks easy. This is why what I've said thus far is reasonably uncontroversial and is well known. Please give me a salawat.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
However, the question is this: how did the prophets elevate people and inspire them to virtue? What did they do? Did they go and speak to people one at a time, take them by the hand, and lead them to a corner, to a mosque, to a school, in order to teach them and educate them? Did the prophets sit in a hermitage and wait for people to come to them, like, for example, the ascetics and mystics of the world? Did people look at the spirit, look at the spiritual state and decide to become like them? Or were the prophets like the philosophers of the world? Did they open a school, set up a black or whiteboard, and call people to come and learn from them? Is this how the prophets were or not? The prophets did not believe in educating only the individual. They did not believe in making people into real human beings one at a time. For example, you might imagine Socrates or Plato did try and, improve people one at a time, but the prophets didn't believe this. Do we really think that someone like Abraham, or Moses, Musa, or Jesus, Isa, or our Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon them all, and his pure family and righteous companions, do we really think that they sat in a school and waited for people to come to them? They were not like this, and neither were the prophet's successors. It's an error, a mistake, to imagine, as some people do, that, for example, Imam As-Sadiq, the sixth Imam of the Muslims, just sat on top of the pulpit and preached to his 4,000 odd students, as some people any unthinkingly suppose. Just because someone counted something like 4,000 individuals as students of and narrators of traditions from Imam Sadiq, some suppose that these 4,000 people came, they sat at his feet while he narrated traditions, answered legal questions, and delivered moral exhortations from the pulpit. This was not the case for Imam Sadiq, nor for his grandfather, nor for his successors, nor for any of the prophets that came before Prophet Muhammad. This was not their way. It is not the job of the prophets to open schools, to deliver sermons, or to educate individuals. The prophets have just one answer to the question, how to make a human being. They have one answer to this question: how to educate a person in accordance with the proper divine paradigm. They have one answer. And this is extremely important. Their answer is by creating an environment that is conducive to the healthy, to his development, to a healthy environment, an environment in which people can grow and learn. That is it. They say this is not possible to do on an individual basis, one person at a time. Instead, you must make a factory. If you want to change a whole society one person at a time, you will die long before you accomplish this. Instead, you have to change society in order to change its people. There must be a system, an assembly line that makes people in the desired fashion. This is really important and this must be understood. The prophets say that the human being is like a fruit tree. Let us say, for example, a date palm or an orange tree. Now, these fruit trees grow and give fruit at certain specific conditions that are appropriate for them, such as, for example, a warm climate. Date palms, typically they grow in places like the south of Iran or the Persian Gulf region or in some Arab countries. And they produce a sweet and delicious fruit in all of these climates. Why? Because the fruit trees thrive best in an environment that has a certain range of temperature, humidity, precipitation, as well as the soil that has a certain mineral composition. There are other conditions also, and these conditions are best fulfilled somewhere like, for example, the south of Iran or the Persian Gulf region. These conditions are not met in the suburbs of London, for example. Now, if you were to bring 1,000 date palms and plant them in the suburb of London, in a suburb of London, where neither the air nor the water nor the soil is conducive to their growth, what will happen? Indeed, if you actually want to grow dates in the suburbs of London, you'd have to bring your date palm and plant it in a greenhouse in your garden, then keep a very close watch on it. You'd have to fertilize and water the soil that it grows in. You'd have to ensure the temperature and humidity is very carefully controlled. This is a lot of very hard work. And after some time, if you are fortunate, you may get maybe one or two unripe dates. Now, you could do this, but why would you? If you want to grow dates, you'd be best placed to do so in an environment that was conducive to the date palm, where you don't have to constantly monitor the temperature, humidity, soil quality, mineral content, etc., etc., in order to ensure the palm is healthy. Where you don't have to expend all of this effort just to get one or two dates. Is it not then more reasonable to, instead of growing date palms one by one in an inappropriate climate, to rather grow them in the right climate? Would it not be better if you could create an environment wherein the date palms would flourish by themselves? Now, clearly, if you want to make the right environment, this too would be a lot of work and effort before you could reap any reward. It would certainly require more effort than to grow a single date palm. But consider the result that this effort would yield. Here, you're expending all of this effort for a single person, for an individual. Whereas there, you're expending all of that effort for a society, for a system, which will affect potentially millions, maybe billions of people and their descendants also. This is the work of the prophets. Understanding this point properly is crucial if we are to be true followers of the prophet's path. This is something we need to reflect very deeply on, as it's not always straightforward or easy to grasp. To that end, we must refer to the Quran, to the lives of the prophets, to the traditions, hadith, narrations that we have on the subject of prophethood. We must study these sources in detail and reflect deeply and constantly. Do not accept this hastily. Do not reject this hastily. A topic of this importance deserves and requires time and consideration. Now, there are some people who may object to what has been said here. Some people will not understand that prophets wanted to create an environment that was conducive to spiritual growth, preferring to imagine that they went to people one at a time in order to guide them, even though this sort of work is beneath the lofty status of God's messengers on earth. But when we look at the Quran, we can understand how the prophets answered this question of how to make a human being, meaning how to elevate and nurture a human being. This is their answer. Their answer to this question was that we need to create a godly society, a tawhid-oriented society, an appropriate environment in which to produce true human beings. Not just one or 10 or even 1,000 human beings individually, but rather in groups, in throngs, and within the guiding light of Islamic teachings. In Quran, in chapter 110, which is Surah An-Nasr, the chapter of the help, verses 1 to 2, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he says, إِذَا جَاءَ نَصْرُ اللَّهِ وَالْفَتْحُ وَرَأَيْتَ النَّاسَ يَدْخُلُونَ فِي دِينِ اللَّهِ أَفْوَاجًا. When God's help comes with victory, and you see people entering God's religion in throngs. Now, in the polytheistic environment of Mecca, the Prophet Muhammad was forced to guide people one at a time. This is because, in order to create a better society, or a system of guiding others, there must be a number of close disciples, a vanguard, if you like. And these were handpicked by the prophet. There is actually no contradiction between this approach and the general scheme of the prophets that we've mentioned. In order to lay the foundation for a new kind of society that he hoped to create, the prophet had no choice but to preach to people one at a time for a period. Among the people that he preached to was Abu Dharr. Another one was Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, another companion of the prophet, and so on and so forth. In this way, he guided between 100 and 200 people in Mecca. These people would become the foundations of the new society, a society built on Tawheed and a society built on submission to God. Now, what a monumental effort it was for the Prophet to guide all of these individual people. What a struggle and what sacrifices it demanded from him. Sometimes you would find fathers forbidding their sons from listening to him. And if someone had sons who had worldly ambitions, they didn't follow him or heed his words. Anyone who inclined towards him in the slightest was harassed, prosecuted, tortured by the polytheists of Mecca. This is what the Prophet was up against in his home city. However, all of this changed when he took his mission to Medina. There, he was able to create a godly and tawhid-oriented society with himself as the head, governing by the laws and commands of God. And it was at that time that God told him, when God's help comes with victory, and you see people entering God's religion in throngs. In summary, the prophets had two major goals. Their fundamental goal was to make people into human beings, to save people from their vices. This was their highest goal. However, there was another goal for which yani, there was which was the preliminary to achieving this primary goal, this highest goal, and that is to create a tawhid-oriented society that is governed by a godly system of government and ruled by God's laws. This also was the goal of all the prophets. If anyone thinks or imagines that God's messengers did not have this goal, then frankly speaking, they need to pay much closer attention when studying Quran, when studying the traditions, the hadith, the narrations, and studying the lives of the prophets. And as we know, beyond the prophets, and in the absence of the prophets, in the absence of the successes of the prophets, the ulama, the scholars, are the ones that are tasked with this responsibility. So this task of creating a tawhid-oriented society, which leads to creating true human beings, is also the task of, for example, Hawza students, Islamic scholars, leaders of communities, all of these people in authority who follow, who say or claim to follow the pathway of the Prophet. Please give me a salawat.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
We'll now discuss two sets of verses from Quran. Firstly, the verse that was right at the beginning of the session from Surah Al-Hadid, the chapter of the Ayan, verse number 25, which reads, "Certainly we sent our prophets with manifest proofs, and we sent down with them the book and the balance, so that humanity may maintain justice, and we sent down iron in which there is great might and uses for humanity, and so that God may know those who help him and his messengers in their absence. Indeed, God is all strong, almighty." So if we examine this, the first portion is certainly we sent our prophets with manifest proofs. The words of the prophets and the evidence they bring is extremely clear. It is something that anyone capable of thinking or reflecting on things will be able to understand. The verse continues, "And we sent down with them the book." What is the book? Al-Kitab. What is this the book? Now, according to Imam Khamenei and many other scholars, many other senior scholars, the book is the totality of teachings and ordinances that constitute the very foundation of the religion, the lessons and doctrines of the religion. This is the book. It encompasses the full ideology of the religion. If we want to sum up the meaning of the book in a single term that is widely used by contemporary thinkers and schools of thought, we would perhaps say that it means ideology, meaning the fundamental principles of the religion, the pillars of its thought, and the basis for its practical doctrines that have a tangible and foundational role in its constitution. Now, in addition to the book, God also sent down the balance, al-mizan. What is the balance? Is it a measure? Is it a scale? Does it mean that every prophet who came brought a measure or a scale underneath his robes? Of course not. The balance refers to the means by which balance and harmony can be reached in society. This is the meaning of the balance in the Quran. It is the means by which justice can be brought about in society. Now, if the prophet was not supposed to lead a community or create a new society, why would he need the balance? Why would he need something that is a means of instituting fairness and equality? What is this means that the prophet was given for creating a just social order? The tools of divine judgment, this is one. The laws governing judgment and settling disputes in society, the means to implement the law, a guarantor of their implementation, all of these are things that the balance could denote. There are laws, a guarantor that these laws will be implemented, and a witness to see them implemented. Just as we see in, for example, democratic nations today, I use the term democratic loosely, we see that the state implements the laws of the society. In nations where there is, for example, a state, a parliament, a legislature, and an implementer of them, this implementer of laws is generally known as the executive branch or the executive, and this supervises society as a whole. According to Imam Khamenei, it is his opinion that it is possible that this term, the balance, refers to this executive power. When we look at traditions concerning these verses, we see one of the interpretations given to the term the balance is that of the Imam. And this is actually found in a very, quite an old tafsir of Quran, but a very reliable one called Tafsir Nur al-Thaqalayn, the tafsir, the exegesis of the light of the two weighty things, which is by Allama al-Huwaizi. Now, Imam Khamenei fully supports this notion that the balance refers to the Imam, as outlined by Al-Huwaizi, because the Imam is the one who separates truth from falsehood within a society. It is he who must make the lines clear. It is he who must bring about justice and equality within a society. Why? Because he is the ruler of society. The Imam is the balance. He is the criterion. Good and evil are measured according to him. The proper ways are applied with him. In addition to this, it is he who oversees society to ensure that people do not overstep the boundaries of justice and equality, and he supervises the implementation of divine law. This is what the narration mentioned by Al-Huwaizi emphasizes. And I'd like to add to this that in the absence of Imam Mahdi, in the time that we live in, which is known as the greater occultation of the awaited Imam, this doesn't mean that a tawhid-oriented society cannot be created, cannot be established. The role, as we've said in previous sessions, in the absence of the Imam, the role falls upon the ulama, upon the scholars, upon the righteous scholars, and upon the Hawza, for example, the seminaries, to step up and to actually implement this, to create that Tawheed-oriented society. So, therefore, the balance is the means by which justice and equality can be realized in society. And this is just one of the things that the Prophet was sent with. Please give me a salawat.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد. عجل.
So the question now arises, why do we need this? What does the book need the Prophet for? Why did we need the Prophet at all if there is a book? Why does there need to be a balance? Why does there need to be a book? The Quran, of course, answers this. So that humanity may maintain justice. So that people can live just lives in an environment of justice. So that people can establish a just way of living. This is one meaning. However, there's another meaning. So that the human being will stand on the basis of justice and live according to the principle of equality. Now, these two meanings sound very similar, but if you pay close attention, you'll see that they're subtly different. So that humanity may maintain justice, so that people can live in an environment of justice, in a just society governed by a just system. This is why the Prophet was sent. So why did God send messengers? To set up a just system of government. They came to make the world a place of fairness and justice. They came to make society and government just and fair. This is why the prophets came. Because it is only within a just society and a just social order that the human being can find the opportunity to actually grow and flourish. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran, he continues, and he says, and we sent down iron. This is very interesting, don't you think? Through speaking and preaching, people set up a just society. Is that it? Is that all? Let us assume that they managed to do this. Do you then think that the devils, wolves, and thieves will leave this just society alone? This is why God sent iron, so that people could defend their most dearly held values. So that when we look at the traditions about this, we see that when the Imam reads the phrase, and we sent down iron, he explains it by saying it means weapons. So you see, and this is very interesting, God mentions weapons alongside the preaching of his prophets, as well as the mission of the prophet to teach people, as well as the idea to create a tawheed-oriented society, God mentions weapons and the power to overcome one's foes. The verse continues, in which there is great might and uses for humanity, so that God may know. Now it goes without saying that God does know. When the Quran says, so that God may know, this means, so that it may be known. The verse continues, those who help him and his messenger in their absence. Those who help him and his messenger in the unseen, with faith in the unseen, without seeing it. They have not seen God. They have not seen his messengers. They have not seen even the successes of the messengers, but they believe in him and they help the prophet. And the verse concludes with, indeed, God is all strong, almighty. Now let us look at the endings of these and many other verses. Look at how meaningful they are. Many times in Quran, you see verses that end with, indeed, God is all hearing and all knowing. Indeed, God is all strong, almighty. Indeed, God is all forgiving, all merciful. This choice of words is not by chance or by coincidence. They haven't been chosen simply because they happen to rhyme, as they would be, for example, in plain poetry. These endpoints to the verses are each chosen according to the meaning of the verse that they end, and which they are supposed to complement. Look at the current verse. Indeed, God is all strong, almighty. So do not think that the prophets came but were not able to create these societies that we sketched out, that they cannot establish justice among the people. No, God, the one who sent them, is almighty. Do not fear those who fight against God's messengers and prophets, for God is almighty and cannot be defeated. This is the meaning of Al-Aziz, almighty, the one who defeats but cannot be defeated by others. If you want to use an idiomatic translation, a single word translation, for example, of this term, you might want to use something like unconquerable or triumphant. So we could say, God is all strong and unconquerable. Please give me a salawat.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
So for the second set of verses that we want to discuss, and then we shall inshallah conclude, these are from Surah A'raf, which is the chapter of the heights, the seventh chapter of the Quran, and they are verses 156 to 157. In this, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he says, "And appoint goodness for us in this world and the hereafter, for indeed we have come back to you." He said, "I visit my punishment on whoever I wish, but my mercy encompasses all things. Soon I will appoint for those who are God-weary and who give zakat, that is the poor due, and those who believe in our signs, those who follow the messenger, the unlettered prophet, whom they find mentioned in the Torah and the gospel in their possession. He directs them to righteousness and deters them from evil, and allows for them all good things and prohibits from them wickedness, and unloads the burdens and shackles that are upon them. Those who believe in him and respect him and support him and follow the light that came down with him, these are the successful." So we want to focus on these verses so as to make clear what we've been discussing, inshallah, God willing. These verses are actually the speech of a believer or a group of believers with God. What do they say? "And appoint goodness for us in this world and in the hereafter, for indeed we have come back to you." We should pay very close attention to this, because when they say "and appoint goodness for us in this world and the hereafter, and for indeed we have come back to you," God responds to them saying, "I visit my punishment on whoever I wish." However, God's will is not something arbitrary or pointless. He does not decide to punish someone for no reason. No, the will of God, as we've discussed previously, follows standards and criteria that He has laid out. God punishes sinners and evil people, certainly. He says, "I visit my punishment on whoever I wish, but my mercy encompasses all things. Soon I will appoint for those who are God-weary and who give zakat, the poor due, and those who believe in our signs." Who are they? Allah goes on to tell us, "Those who follow the messenger, the unlettered prophet." Now, there is a long-standing disagreement among the scholars about the meaning of unlettered, or for, in Arabic, the word is ummi, and it's where it's used in the context of the unlettered prophet or an Nabiyyul ummi. Some people say that unlettered means someone who is illiterate, while others say it means someone who was from the masses. Ummah, he's leveraging from the word ummah, community, or someone who is connected to his mother, someone who has not been influenced by any particular culture. Some say that ummi means someone from the mother of all towns, which is Umm al-Qura, which is another name for Mecca. In any case, this is not really our concern, as our concern is not with the interpretations of the word ummi. Only that the people God is talking about are those who follow this unlettered prophet, whom they find mentioned in the Torah and the Gospel in their possession. Now, these two scriptures foretold the coming of the prophet. How did they describe him in their predictions? "He directs them to righteousness, to those virtues which are known by human reason, by aql, and by human nature, fitrah, and deters them from evil, those things which are alien to human reason and nature. Allows for them all good things. because every good thing is found in the religion and prohibits from them and prohibits for them wickedness, meaning he withholds unclean things from them. This is how an Islamic society should be. In an Islamic society, everything that is good for the human being, whether for his mind, his heart, his spirit, his body, etc., should be readily available to them. Knowledge, education, piety, wealth, whatever is beneficial for the human being, it should be there for him. Conversely, whatever is bad for the human being should not be available to anyone and prohibits for them wickedness, whether by keeping it out of their hands or by implementing laws that do so, and unloads the burdens. One of the qualities of the prophet is that he unburdens the people from the burden of ignorance, the burden of false traditions, the burden of inhumane systems and inhuman social orders, tyranny, the burden of tyranny, of dictatorship, of exploitation. Whatever the burden, he lifts it from their shoulders and the shackles that are upon them. What shackles are these? Were there literal shackles on the feet of the Meccans when the Prophet came to them? Were there collars and chains around their necks? Were they all prisoners? Clearly, these are not literal metal shackles or chains. So, what are they? We should reflect on this. And to the audience, I invite you to reflect on this and work out for yourself what you think these are. And feel free to share it in the comments or in the discussion. What were the fetters that bound the Meccans? What were they enthralled to? To cruel traditions, ignorant superstitions, and man-made customs. It is they who will reach their destination as human beings. We have now covered the idea of the goal of the prophets. And in addition to the previous three sessions on prophethood, we have a God willing, a sensible and clearer understanding of the subject of prophethood, a subject that is critical to our ideology, and that is a clear manifestation of the mercy of God, of the justice of God. In the next session, inshallah, God willing, we will try to cover and understand the starting point of the prophetic call, and this will build upon everything that we have learned thus far. All of these points that we have discussed so far are extremely important elements of the ideology of the true Islam of Muhammad, the school of thought of resistance, the Islam delivered by all of the prophets of God, and that Islam that is the key to the liberation of all of humanity from the shackles of being the lowest of the low, so that humanity can soar and regain its rightful place as the best of the best. وآخر الدعوان أن الحمد لله رب العالمين والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Please give me a salawat and we can go to the nasheed.
هذه الجنة لا جنة هذه موسى والجوار
هذه الجنة لا جنة عاد هذه جنة موسى والجوار هذه الجنة لا جنة عاد هذه جنة موسى والجوار أزلفت للمؤمنين المتقين فادخلوها بسلام آمنين هي حصن وملاذ للعباد هذه جنة موسى والجواد
روضة تحرسها عين السماء هبطت فيها قلوب الأنبياء وإذا الله نداء
ووضعناك وزرك
نصرك الذي أنقض ظهرك ووضعنا عنك وزرك الذي أنقض ظهرك.
أنت في الفردوس لا ذات العماد،
هذه جنة موسى والجواد،
روضة زينها رب رؤوف، دانيات للملأ فيها القطوف، أنبياء الله تأتيها صفوف، وبها الأملك تسعى وتطوف.
صرت يا زائر قدرك ورفعنا لك ذكرك، صرت يا زائر قدرك ورفعنا لك ذكرك.
زرت روضا زينت فيها البلاد،
هذه جنة موسى والجواد،
إنما الحج لدى البيت الحرام حجة في كل عام، ها هنا كعبة موسى والمقام، كل يوم فيه حج للأنام.
يملم ربا بصيرا واذكر الله كثيرا، يملم ربا بصيرا واذكر الله كثيرا.
خدمة الزائر باب للمراد،
هذه جنة موسى والجواد، هذه الجنة لا جنة عاد، هذه جنة موسى والجواد، هذه الجنة لا جنة عاد، هذه جنة موسى والجواد، أزلفت للمؤمنين المتقين، فادخلوها بسلام آمنين، هي حصن ومناب للعباد، هذه جنة موسى والجواد.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد، اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد، اللهم صل على
سلام على آل ياسين، السلام عليك يا داعي الله ورباني يا آيات، السلام عليك يا باب الله وديان دين، السلام عليك يا خليفة الله وناصر حق، السلام عليك يا حجة الله ودليل إرادته، السلام عليك يا تالي كتاب الله وترجمانه، السلام عليك في آناء ليلك وأطراف نهارك، السلام عليك يا بقية الله في أرضه، السلام عليك يا ميثاق الله الذي أخذه ووكده، السلام عليك يا وعد الله الذي ضمنه، السلام عليك أيها العلم المنصور والعلم المسبوق والغوث والرحمة الواسعة وعدا غير مكذوب، السلام عليك حين تقوم، السلام عليك حين تقعد، السلام عليك حين تقرأ وتبين، السلام عليك حين تصلي وتقنط، السلام عليك حين تركع وتسجد، السلام عليك حين تهلل وتكبر، السلام عليك حين تحمد وتستغفر، السلام عليك حين تصبح وتمسي، السلام عليك في الليل إذا يغشى والنهار إذا تجلى، السلام عليك أيها الإمام المأمون، السلام عليك أيها المقدم المأمون، السلام عليك بجوامع السلام، أشهدك يا مولاي أني أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له، وأن محمدا عبده ورسوله، لا حبيب إلا هو وأهله، وأشهدك يا مولاي أن عليا أمير المؤمنين حجته، والحسن حجته، والحسين حجته، وعلي ابن الحسين حجته، ومحمد ابن علي حجته، وجعفر ابن محمد حجته، وموسى ابن جعفر حجته، وعلي ابن موسى حجته، ومحمد ابن علي حجته، وعلي ابن محمد حجته، والحسن ابن علي حجته، وأشهد أنك حجة الله، أنتم الأول والآخر، وأن رجعتكم حق لا ريب فيها، يوم لا ينفع نفسا إيمانها لم تكن آمنت من قبل أو كسبت في إيمانها خيرا. وأن الموت حق، وأن ناكرا ونكيرا حق، وأشهد أن النشر حق، والبعث حق، وأن الصراط حق، والمرصاد حق، والميزان حق، والحشر حق، والحساب حق، والجنة والنار حق، والوعد والوعيد بهما حق. يا مولاي شقي من خالفكم، وسعد من أطاعكم، فاشهد على ما أشهدتك علي وأنا ولي لك بريء من عدوك، فالحق ما رضيتموه، والباطل ما سخطتموه، والمعروف ما أمرتم به، والمنكر ما نهيتم عنه، فنفسي مؤمنة بالله وحده لا شريك له وبرسوله وبأمير المؤمنين وبكم يا مولاي أولكم وآخركم ونصرتي معدة لكم ومودتي خالصة لكم آمين.